I call the meeting of the House Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee to order. Our first order of business for today is the approval of the minutes for February 24th, 2026. Vice Chair Coulter, may I have a motion to approve the minutes for February 24th, 2026?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have reviewed the incredibly extensive minutes from our previous meeting and move their approval.
Thank you, Vice Chair Coulter. Vice Chair Coulter moves the approval of the minutes for February 24th, 2026. Is there any member discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of Vice Chair Coulter's motion to approve the minutes for February 24th, 2026, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails, and the minutes for February 24th, 2026 are adopted. Members, I am convening this hearing today to bring to public account the human rights atrocities that have been committed by federal immigration customs enforcement agents on college campuses throughout the state of Minnesota, and the destabilizing, disruptive climate of fear that it has created for students, faculty, and employees. A little further background for our members of the committee and members of the public. A deeply disturbing pattern of federal overreach began last year with abductions and detainments of students attending Minnesota's colleges and universities. What started as a handful of incidents grew to total chaos with the escalation of Operation Metro Surge. Let us be clear, armed, masked agents sowing fear and racial prejudice on campuses should be a nightmare scenario for every member of this committee and every resident of our state. But it's become a chilling new reality for students who, regardless of their immigration status, are afraid to go to class because they live in fear of the possibility of being assaulted or abducted by ICE. It's impossible to learn and succeed in such a chilling environment. It goes against everything that we have worked so hard to accomplish in this committee. If our students are terrified to go to a college or university in our state, how can they possibly focus on learning the curriculum? It should be a badge of honor for us members that students from all over the country and the world seek a higher education here in Minnesota. Our diverse student body adds to our strength. It leads to a stronger workforce, economic growth, and is to the benefit of all Minnesotans. We on this committee have a responsibility to ensure that all students, regardless of where they come from or what they look like, feel safe on Minnesota's campuses. We must uphold public safety in a way that respects the constitutional rights of Minnesota students. Our objective today at this hearing is to learn more about the impact that Operation Metro Surge has had on our campuses and universities and on the lives of those who live, learn, and work on our campuses. And we want to learn more about how we can come together in this moment, given everything we've been through, to achieve the shared goal of rejecting racial discrimination and protecting our campuses for all of Minnesota students. I want to thank the testifiers who are here today, as well as the presenters, for coming forward and having the courage to participate in this hearing and share your story during what has been an incredibly difficult time in our state. And I want to be clear that I will not tolerate anything less than a respectful and civil discussion. With that, members, I would like to proceed to our testifiers. And our first testifier for the day is President Paul Pribinow from Augsburg University.
Mr. Chair, can I just address something for a second?
Representative Novotny.
In the absence of Chair Rarick, are we here for a hearing?
Yes, Representative Novotny.
And I'm not done, Mr. Chair, but thank you for giving me a little latitude. You say we're here for a hearing. We're here to find out the facts. You just used phrases like human rights atrocities, deeply disturbing, and whatever your other talking points that I'm sure have been well thought out, media tested.
Representative Novotny, Representative Novotny, it is not permitted in this committee to besmirch members' motives or personalities. If you would like to ask a technical question about the proceedings of this hearing, you may do so, but I will not allow you to question the motives or personalities of myself or of any member of this committee. Representative Novotny.
I will rephrase, Mr. Chair. Are we here to find out the facts, or are we here to make a predetermined presentation of what you've already decided? That's my question. We have an hour and a half of legislators' time. Do we want to find out the facts, or?
Representative Novotny, we are here to find out the facts, and with that, I will welcome our first testifier, President Paul Pribino from Augsburg University. And members, I will also, just so that as Representative Novotny made clear, we want to be respectful of everyone's time, so we will have our testifiers come and share their experiences with us, and then we are going to hold questions until after we've gotten through all of the presenters. With that, President Pribino, welcome to the Higher Education Committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Representative Welgemut and members of the committee, I'm Paul Pribino, the president of Augsburg University in Minneapolis, and I'm very grateful for this opportunity to share testimony about the impact of Operation Metro Surge on Minnesota's colleges and universities, and particularly on Augsburg. Relentless, exhausting, unprecedented, words that only begin to capture how profoundly Operation Metro Surge has impacted our campus community in recent months. As you know, Augsburg's campus is located in the heart of Minneapolis, is seamlessly integrated with the surrounding Cedar Riverside neighborhood. The city in that way acts as an extension of our classrooms, offering our students extraordinary opportunities for learning and for service. By the same token, what happens in our city reaches into the heart of Augsburg. For many of our students, faculty, and staff, Operation Metro Surge has raised profound questions about belonging, safety, and justice. At Augsburg, as on many college campuses that serve a large number of low-income and first-generation students from diverse backgrounds, these questions are not hypothetical. I think, as many of you know, Augsburg has become one of the most diverse private colleges in the country over the past 15 years, and so in some ways, the makeup of our student body made us a particular target. For example, many of our students have been stopped and interrogated by ICE agents, including while driving to or from campus and while walking between campus buildings. And the only reason that we can imagine they were stopped was because of the color of their skin. Some have a family member who was directly impacted. Some are now caring for younger siblings after a parent was detained, or they are working to support their families. Many of our Somali American neighbors in Cedar Riverside, including those with citizenship or legal status, are afraid to go out in public, fearing harassment, detainment, or worse. And we have organized a really robust volunteer system by which we are actually bringing food up into the plaza, for example, in Cedar Riverside, to meet the needs, the food needs of those residents of the plaza. Most chillingly, at least three Augsburg students that we know of have been detained by ICE this academic year. One of those detentions, as I think most of you know, took place in an Augsburg-owned parking lot on campus on December 6th. And as we understand it, we may still only be one of two college campuses in the country where an ICE enforcement opportunity actually happened on the college campus. That day, a group of armed, masked ICE agents targeted an undergraduate student and confronted members of our community directly outside a residence hall. Without producing a warrant, the agents aimed weapons at witnesses that included staff and students, while many more students watched from their dormitory windows. As you can imagine, the Augsburg community was deeply shaken by this event and its aftermath. Many of you perhaps saw the videotapes of the incident. There were about 16 or 18 ICE agents pointing guns at a group of about 10 or 12 students and a couple of unarmed campus safety officers. After national media attention and public statements by the Department of Homeland Security and ICE, Augsburg received two bomb threats in mid-December, prompting two building evacuations within 24 hours during the final week of our fall term. A similar threat, bomb threat, followed in mid-January. Spring semester at Augsburg began on January 20th, 2 weeks after the killing of Renee Macklin Good and 4 days before the shooting of Alex Preddy. Despite the drone of helicopters overhead, campus was quieter than usual because so many students had chosen virtual class options. After Good was killed, Augsburg immediately pivoted to increase virtual options for students, faculty, and staff who are unable or unwilling to come to campus because of safety concerns or family needs. We added several hundred online courses through a combination of new sections, raising caps in existing courses, and moving a small number of classes to Zoom. The number of online course enrollments increased significantly for the spring semester, and since early January, our academic advisors have held hundreds of one-on-one meetings with students to curate individual course loads in response to their ICE concerns. In these fraught times, our goal has been to prioritize in-person learning as much as possible. That's who we are, and we wanted to make that our priority, while at the same time allowing individuals the flexibility to make the best choices they could for their own circumstances. This work is ongoing, along with broader efforts to support students, faculty, and staff during a time of intense stress and anxiety. In January, for example, more than 350 students, almost 10% of our student body, had active cases with Augsburg's student care team, a cross-functional group that coordinates support resources on campus. That's more than triple the number of cases in the month of November. Augie Basics Housing, a program to address emergency housing needs among our students, has seen a large spike in applications driven by increased ICE activity in Minneapolis and particularly in our Cedar Riverside neighborhood. Twice as many students are currently using the program compared to the same time last year. And a number of students have had no choice but to elect a temporary leave of absence for the spring semester. Currently, twice as many students are on leave compared to last year at this time. As with any community, Augsburg students, faculty, and staff have diverse viewpoints, including how best to respond to our current moment. But we do share a belief in the historic values that have defined higher education's role in our democracy for 250 years: human dignity, academic freedom, social mobility, and the rule of law. And we also believe that education is resistance, not to any political party or administration, but to the forces of dehumanization, violence, and injustice wherever they are deployed. These values were present at Augsburg's founding by Norwegian immigrants in 1869, and they endure today. In this challenging time, they continue to inspire our calling at Augsburg to serve our neighbors and educate students for engaged citizenship. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. President. Please stick around for member questions once all the testifiers have had the opportunity to present. Our next testifier is Jenna Chernega, the IFO president and Winona State Sociology faculty member. We also have Mr. Mark Grant with the Minnesota State College faculty. Ms. Chernega, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you so much. Chair Wolgamott, members of the committee, my name is Jenna Chernega. I'm the president of the IFO. We represent the faculty, coaches, counselors, and librarians across our seven Minnesota State Universities. I'm here today to testify on the profound destabilizing impact of Operation Metro Surge on our campuses. What we are witnessing is not just a shift in policy, it is the systematic erosion of the safe haven status that higher education requires to function. This testimony is all the more important today, given the events at Columbia University this morning, where a student was detained by ICE agents inside their residence hall. And the administration of Columbia has said that those agents lied to gain access to that residence hall. Earlier this month, the IFO polled our faculty, and the results were staggering. 94% of the faculty reported students expressing extreme stress or safety concerns regarding immigration enforcement on or near campus. 91% reported the same level of distress amongst their colleagues. As you know, this isn't theoretical. The Metropolitan State University faculty president messaged me one morning, "ICE is at Metro." I rushed to campus to find agents gathering directly across the street, and I spent 2 hours in my car in the parking lot, essentially acting as a lookout ready to protect the campus community if they stepped foot on campus. Unfortunately, the occupation has left our communities traumatized. It is fundamentally altering how we teach and how our students learn. For one, we have disappearing students. Faculty report that some student groups have stopped meeting because of fear of leaving their dorms. Students of color who usually take the light rail to campus in the cities are noticeably absent. The occupation has created a visa catch-22 for our international students who are terrified to leave their homes for an in-person class. And yet, if they stay home, they risk violating the very in-person learning visa requirements that allow them to be here. It has impacted our faculty workload. 48% of the surveyed faculty reported a significant increase in workload due to this crisis. They are rewriting curriculum to move classes online or canceling field trips simply because the risk of encountering enforcement agents is too dangerous. In St. Cloud, Mankato, Moorhead, Bemidji, Marshall, and Winona, the presence of enforcement activities, even if off campus, has created a climate of paralysis. Without clear, sensitive location protections, our campuses no longer are centers of learning and innovation. They are centers of anxiety and fear. As a union president, the hardest thing I've had to do this year is look a faculty member in the eye and admit that I cannot guarantee their safety or the safety of their students. We must recognize that Operation Metro Surge is not just an enforcement action, it has created an education crisis. We must protect the integrity of our campuses so that all students, regardless of their background, can pursue their degree without the threat of masked, unidentified agents wrestling them into unmarked vehicles and driving away. IFO faculty remain dedicated to peacefully protecting our basic human rights. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Mr. Grant, welcome back to the Higher Education Committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Wolgamott. Committee members, thank you for the opportunity to share our perspective on this issue. For the record, my name is Mark Grant. I'm a 28-year communication study faculty member at Dakota County Technical College, and I currently assist in the governmental relations work on behalf of Minnesota State College faculty. As is often the case, providing a single faculty perspective on issues like this can prove challenging, as that perspective is oftentimes as varied as the communities that we serve on our 47 campuses in nearly every corner of the state. With that said, though, I do want to share just a few points from the faculty of MSCF. Number one, as open access, mainly non-residential campuses, the conditions our students exist in inevitably become the environments that we teach in. It's unavoidable. So I want to start by saying Minnesota State College faculty stands in support of our students. If you're looking for the impact on our campuses and our classrooms, I can't think of anybody's perspective more important than the students we serve. I know you're going to be hearing from them today, and I strongly encourage all of you to listen very closely to what they have to say. Two, while we have not had an incident involving ICE on our campuses yet, we view that more as a function of luck than anything structural having to do with our campuses. Nonetheless, our faculty are bracing for such an incident and the inevitable fallout for students, staff, and faculty that such an encounter brings. With that in mind, we do think doing something to prevent the potential for future actions on our campuses similar to the ones that we've seen in our communities is prudent. Three, we see and we know the impact on our coworkers and our students who have been adversely affected by ICE's presence, regardless of where that impact has occurred. We have encouraged faculty to give space and grace to students to the extent that faculty have the authority to do so via academic freedom. We have offered to enter into an agreement with Minnesota State, with the Minnesota State system, to codify and clarify the extent of those rights. In short, we want individual faculty to be able to meet individual students where they are and provide them with the support they so deserve. We care deeply about our students and their well-being. We also care deeply about our coworkers who are showing up for students while dealing with the trauma they've experienced themselves. And last, while the immediate impact of ICE's actions on individuals is somewhat evident, we believe that we have yet to fully realize the long-term impact on our institutions. We know that enrollment has been affected this spring, and we fully expect that impact to extend into next school year, especially if there's a perception that our campuses are fundamentally unsafe places to be. Financial support for our institutions in recognition of the work done under these impossible circumstances by the system employees will be needed and will be much appreciated. We get a lot of pats on the back, but at the end of the day, that doesn't pay for groceries if you lose your job due to falling enrollment. MSCF recognizes that there's nothing easy about any of this. We know that you have a difficult task balancing a number of potential priorities. Our goal is to let you know how we are impacted, ask for your support, and trust that you will do right by the students and employees of Minnesota State. Thank you.
Mr. Grant, Ms. Chernega, thank you very much for your testimony. We hope that you'll please stick around if members have questions for you once we've had the opportunity to hear from all the presenters. Our next testifier is Ms. Jennifer Irwin from AFSCME Local 4001. Ms. Irwin, welcome to the House Higher Education Committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, Chair Wolgamott and representatives. My name is Jennifer Irwin, and I am the president of the AFSCME Mid State Policy Committee. The position from our Board of Trustees and Chancellor is that ICE is not within our walls. And while it is true that no ICE activity has taken place within the physical boundaries of our institutions, the fear experienced by our staff and students is undeniable. This fear affects our ability to attend classes, come to work, shop for groceries, and even feel safe leaving their homes. Its impact does not stop at the campus gates. It follows them into our classrooms, offices, and common spaces. In that sense, the fear is present within our campus walls every minute of every day. The presence of ICE activity in our communities is discouraging students from registering for classes and is already reflected in our declining current attendance and future enrollment numbers. Additionally, ICE activity affects our staff by creating an atmosphere of constant anxiety, impacting their ability to focus at work, commute safely, care for their families, and fully participate in campus life. For example, yes, it did not happen on campus, but we have had an AFSCME member in St. Paul who, while in his community, was detained for 13 days while he tried to prove his legal status. Thankfully, he was able to prove his legal status and was able to return to his home and work. But this absolutely is a real life situation that adds to the anxiety felt by our members. So again, while the Board of Trustees and Chancellor Olson respond that there has not been ICE activities within our walls, I can assure you that it is most definitely within our walls. Thank you for your time today.
Ms. Irwin, thank you so much for your testimony. We ask you please stick around in case members have any questions for you at the conclusion of the presentations.
Thank you.
Our next testifier is a student from Concordia University, St. Paul, named Brendan. Brendan, we would like to extend you a warm welcome to the House Higher Education Committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much, Chair. Good afternoon, members of the House of Higher Education Committee. My name is Brendan Frazier. I am the student body president of Concordia University, St. Paul. I also serve as the Legislative Mapsis Chair of Minnesota Association of Private College Students, representing students from 18 different institutions throughout the state. Thank you for having us here today. As we know, the past few months, the state of Minnesota has been under hostile occupation from the federal administration. Immigration, Customs, and Enforcement have racially profiled citizens, terrorized communities. These actions have caused public outcry for accountability and immediate removal of ICE presence, both in the Twin Cities and the state at large. We are here today on behalf of our higher education institutions, advocating for those harmed by Operation Metro Surge and sharing the impact from our prospective campuses. As an advocate of my campus community, I can assure you the concern for safety has been very real. Renee Good, a mother and a civilian, had been killed on January 7th. Classes at Concordia University started January 12th. Between that period, I had received messages from dozens of concerned students regarding safety procedures, Zoom class options, lockdown tactics, and even sharing personal stories, some directed personally by ICE. I've spoken with our university's International Student Services Office. Students who completed their visa processes, received their documentation, and came here to pursue their education, many of them commute. And to our campus, they have expressed valid fear and concern of safety. As a result of this, class attendance has suffered and many class sizes have diminished. International students not only contribute to CSP, but to our state as well. According to the Institute of International Education Statistics, the year 2024 to 2025, there are nearly 15,000 international students who attend Minnesota schools, bringing an estimated $488 million worth of revenue to the state. Our international peers not only contribute to our universities, but they also contribute to the direct success and growth of our state. In meeting with members of my university student life team, our campus food shelf, titled Comments Cupboard, has seen record-breaking attendance. Last year, our monthly average of pantry visits had been 78 adults with 904 pounds of food each month. This year, in January alone, we nearly doubled that amount with over 144 adults and over 1,400 pounds of food distributed to communities. Many dedicated staff members have also delivered food to families and students who have been too afraid to leave their homes due to ICE presence in the city. This has proven that our food pantry is a vital resource on our campus. I'm very proud of my university community, our student life team, and our student directors, David and Kenneth, for security efforts and their efforts to student safety. I advocate for policy efforts introducing and strengthening state student privacy laws and sharing restrictive data, particularly for immigration status and for home addresses. Tangible efforts also include utilizing the state budget surplus to support students' families and businesses that have struggled, investing in emergency rental assistance for low-income students who have struggled to meet work needs due to their fear of going out to the community. Representatives, neighbors, and my fellow Minnesotans, there has been much harm done by this administration. Communities have been terrorized, and injustices have occurred in our streets that have gained international attention. Despite these injustices we have seen on our screens, we have seen our neighbors in the streets, everyday civilians becoming community advocates, our colleges, who hold some of the most ambitious, bright, and innovative young scholars. As we carve a path forward, let us please implement intentional efforts to those who have been harmed. Let's invest in strategies that build stronger safeguards to support students' futures. Thank you.
Brandon, thank you so much for your testimony. We ask you please stick around so that you can be available for member questions at the conclusion of the presentations. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Our next testifier is Jonathan Fitzgerald, the co-chair of the Legislative Affairs Committee at Minnesota State Mankato. All right, Mr. Fitzgerald, welcome to the Higher Education Committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Jonathan Fitzgerald. I'm a sophomore at Minnesota State Mankato. I'm originally from White Bear Lake, but since getting here, I have established myself within the community, enough to the extent where I call it my home. Among the numerous positions I now hold within Mankato, not just on university, but also within the surrounding city and county, I serve as the co-chair of our Legislative Affairs Committee, which is a branch of Minnesota State Mankato student government. As a part of this position, I led the response to increasing ICE presence within our community on a student administrative level. On January 13th, day two of our spring semester, I did something I never thought I'd have to do and convened a staff consisting of my fellow students in an emergency meeting in order to discuss and plan a response to Operation Metro Surge. Mankato had already proven itself a target with the months-long detention of our student, Muhammad Haq, which had occurred not even a year ago. Haq was detained again during the spring semester for a period of a few days. For the first time in my life, I had to formulate and execute a plan to protect my fellow students from a hostile government entity. Following the killing of Renee Nicole Good and the assaults on our community members, it became necessary to prepare our campus for future security and safety risks. We have increased medical supplies in accessible areas, connected our security services to the community, and increased grant coverage and facilitated volunteer mutual aid networks to assist our students. We have had to prepare for incidents of violence on campus like what we have seen in Minneapolis. Our students, not just international, are deeply afraid. An example of the fear and terror brought about by Immigration and Customs Enforcement is Thursday, January 15th, that same week. That day was the highest ICE presence I can personally remember seeing around our campus. Reports flooded in of plainclothes agents going from housing complex to housing complex, getting closer and closer to our university. Eventually, their presence was confirmed at a series of apartment blocks directly next to our campus. They were knocking on doors, demanding papers from passerbys, and harassing both students and community members. Their presence created an atmosphere of extreme paranoia, mistrust, and fear as these reports flared in. At the point where they were next to our campus, everybody froze. People were running from building to building, looking over their shoulders, and becoming extremely suspicious of their fellow students and community members, as again, they were not identifying themselves and existing in plain clothes. Without proper state, city, or administrative communication, the student body had no clear narrative of what was happening. We were forced to rely on social media accounts and desperately try and get into contact with local Ice Watch groups, which, despite their passion, were still in their budding phases. My personal apartment building closed itself off to outsiders. Staff and on campus were forced to make the decision on whether to keep their offices open to the public or closed to students only. Our campus community was afraid not because of issues of misinformation or false narratives, but rather because of the harm done to several of our community members, including MNSU alumni. People suffered unprovoked attacks at the hands of ICE agents within the city. A particularly brutal incident occurred the Monday before the 15th, where ICE agents pepper sprayed an individual and left her in the bitter cold. This moment was testified to by an MNSU student senator who stopped and missed work to assist this woman, as federal agents left her blind, hurting, and alone in the street. Our students cannot properly receive their education or perform their work in an environment where they are constantly worrying about their safety and the safety of their family and friends. My constituency has been forced to watch their families, loved ones, and community members beaten, dragged from the streets, and kidnapped to later be held without access to due process. Minnesota State University Mankato relies heavily on our international constituency, which is actively under assault. To defend higher education and the educational resources of Greater Mankato, we have to ensure our students have a safe, stable learning environment, which is free of violent interference and hosts a guaranteed sense of safety. Since Metro Search has started, we have seen a massive decline in the amount of international students entering our campus, one which will not be remedied by the amount of domestic enrollment that we're seeing. We need these people in our communities. They are assets, not threats. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Fitzgerald, and we ask you please stick around so that you can be available for questions at the conclusion of the presentations. Our next testifier is Sudi Otto, the president of LEAD MN. Ms. Otto, welcome to the House Higher Education Committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Wolgamott. My name is Sudi Otto, and I am a student at RCTC and the president of LEAD MN. LEAD MN is the student-led association that represents the two-year community and technical college students in the Mid-State system. I am here to testify on behalf of a dear friend. I'm going to read you the story they wrote word for word, and I hope you don't just listen to these words, but truly hear them. On the day it started, at the place I felt safe, in the community I called home, I thought about what was happening in our state. The years of math classes I took had me analyzing the chances of seeing an ICE agent, the chances of encountering one, the chances of being taken by one. Unlikely, I said to myself, 20% chance at worst. I was at my work break when I got a notification from a Facebook group announcing that ICE activity started in my city. I was at work when I saw this during the tail end of my shift. Seeing this made me feel uneasy, like the foundation beneath me was beginning to shake. 50% chance. Rochester is a big city, I thought to myself. I remember the moment clearly when my coworker stopped me, telling me that they saw what looked like ICE agents outside of our workplace. 80% chance. The shaky feeling beneath me turned into unbearable violent tremors. The air around me started to thin. This was it, I thought to myself. The years my family and I put into building a better life in the place we called home was coming to an end. I had a panic attack in that break room. The sterile, sanitized smell of my workplace I grew to love felt nauseating. After what felt like hours after my shift ended, I made my way home and got there safely, something I cannot say the same for many others in our community. I did not go to work the next day. In fact, I didn't go to work the next few days. What ran through my mind in those few days was not how I'm able to afford missing work, not how I'm able to afford missing class, nor was the dwindling food in my fridge, but it was how the system that was created to protect us failed us. With no audience for these thoughts, fears, and concerns, I felt helpless. Helpless because my parents, my guardian angels, who supported me through everything, had made the decision to leave America. Or should I say that decision was made for them. The future that I saw so vividly was crumbling in front of me. My education, my career, my safety, all put at risk because I looked different, talked different, and was different. My DACA status didn't protect me from the discriminatory campaign launched in our community, but my story isn't different from others. My fellow students feel the same sense of impending danger every day. When students feel unsafe, they begin prioritizing survival over education. They stay home instead of attending class. They take on responsibilities to protect or financially support their families. We look to you to support, for protection, for guidance. I witnessed firsthand how my community was affected. Families stopped going to work, children stopped attending school, people were missing medical appointments and avoiding going to work or even grocery stores not because they committed crimes, but because they feared being targeted for who they are or how they look. I cannot tell you my name, nor can I be there to testify in person. I fear the unspeakable will happen if I do. But what I can tell you is that Minnesota has been my home for most of my life. I'm not asking for special treatment. I am asking for students to be protected so that education remains accessible, stable, and safe. The right to pursue an education is not a crime. Thank you to the committee for your time today and for hearing the story and others here today.
Ms. Addo, thank you so much for sharing that story. And if your friend is watching, we want your friend to know how much we appreciate the courage in sharing that story and that we didn't just hear it, but we listened to it. And we really, again, appreciate your friend having the courage to share that perspective with us. So if they're watching, I hope they know that. And if not, we hope you'll pass that along. And we also hope that you'll stick around in case members have any questions for you at the conclusion of the presentations.
Thank you
and to your friend.
Thank you.
Our next testifier is Will Luther, the Director of State Affairs from the Undergraduate Student Government. Mr. Luther, welcome to the House Higher Education Committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Wolgamon, members. My name is William Luther. I'm the Director of State Affairs for the Undergrad Student Government at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. We as a student government represent over 30,000 undergraduates at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. Today's discussion is important. Students from all parts of the state returned to class after heartbreaking events that happened in the city where we study. As a member of our student government, we've heard countless stories from students who were afraid to leave their dorms, apartments, or even homes in fear of being swept up by immigration enforcement, regardless of whether they're a U.S. citizen or a lawful permanent resident. One thing that makes the University of Minnesota Twin Cities great is its location in Minneapolis, where students live in the city the New York Times called the best city for new grads. A large majority of our students also live in off-campus housing, either commuting from home or living in off-campus housing in neighborhoods such as Dinky, Marcy, Como, Cedar Riverside. Neighborhoods that Representative Knorr represents. Unfortunately, although Fourth Amendment protections do protect students on university property, it does not protect them on the street, does not protect them on their commute on the way to class. And this has caused a lot of frustration among students choosing between, do I go to class, do I, you know, stay on top of my academics, or do I stay home and be safe? Do I, you know, skip grocery runs? And it's really unfortunate. And we heard from a lot of students that seems to be the case. One of the students we heard from was Tan. His stepfather was swept up by immigration enforcement during the surge. His stepfather was a refugee from Vietnam who's lived in the country for over 40 years. With his father taken during the surge, it's hard for Tan to juggle schoolwork, sort out his family's finances, and find legal support for his father. On top of that, the constant worry about not knowing where his stepfather is, where he will be taken, and whether his stepfather will even get to see a judge, all takes a toll on Tan and his academics. Operation Metro Surge has impacted students in many ways. Like Tan, students with parents who were taken by immigration enforcement now face the challenge of both juggling their role as a full-time student and also sorting out family finances, working, and trying to find legal representation for their guardians. I just want to note that the university did allow students to have an online option, hybrid option, after the killing of Alex Preti. However, on February 5th, Provost Ritter and the university announced that that option would be discontinued and has been discontinued since February 16th of this month. We urge this committee to take action to protect students during these unprecedented times. Thank you.
Mr. Luther, thank you so much for sharing your testimony. We ask you please stick around in case members have any questions for you at the conclusion of presentations.
Thank you.
Our next testifier, our next two testifiers are from the University of Minnesota. I would like to welcome Greg Goldman and Gretchen Ritter to the testifier table. While they make their way to the table, I just want to acknowledge for the committee, Representative Novotny, we did acknowledge your question. We're just for the sake of time and everything, we're going to get through all the testifiers, and then we can call folks back up. That's how we're going to do it to make sure we get to hear from all of our presenters. But we do have you first on the list, Representative
Novotny. That's all I was asking for, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Yep. Okay, great. Who would like to proceed first? All right. Ms. Ritter, welcome to the Higher Education Committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chair Wolgemont, members of the committee, thank you for the invitation to be here today. My name is Gretchen Ritter. I am the Executive Vice President and Provost for the Twin Cities campus and the Chief Academic Officer for the University of Minnesota. I'm joined today by my colleague, Greg Goldman, who is our Executive Vice President for Finance and Operations. As many of the other witnesses have reported, Operation Metro Surge has been quite disruptive to our operations and to the atmosphere on our campuses. As a university, our primary focus has been the safety and well-being of our students, balanced with an approach that prioritizes educational continuity. From an academic perspective, we directed our colleges, schools, and campuses throughout January and early February to approve hybrid learning requests for students with in-person attendance concerns. The requirements, modalities, and accreditation standards differ by school and college, and so they were in the best position to support their students in the correct ways. We returned to regular class modality, including in-person classroom instruction, on February 16th for several reasons. First and foremost, because we believe that that was what was best for our students. We are a primarily in-person residential institution, which is what our students chose when they came here, and we feel a responsibility to maintain our in-person instruction whenever it is safely possible to do so. Second, by mid-February, we were hearing from many students who told us that being in person was better for their learning and for their overall well-being. Fewer than 10% of our students sought approval for remote or flexible options when those were available, and even within that group, many chose to attend in person. That said, it must be acknowledged that in that smaller group, the majority were students of color and international students. Third, we have a responsibility to support students whose status depends on in-person attendance. In-person attendance is essential for meeting requirements tied to visas, financial aid, and specific hands-on courses such as labs. That said, throughout this process, we have made clear that we are here to support the success of every one of our students, whatever their circumstances. Our campuses, schools, and colleges are continuing to communicate about the ways they are supporting students, they are reaching out individually to them, and there to address any of those with ongoing concerns. The university has encouraged students to schedule an advising session to identify the best options for their particular situation. We also regularly convene our deans and academic leaders from around the university to help us respond appropriately as the situation evolves. Let me add that one of the positives that has emerged from all of this has been the commitment to community on our campuses. Even as our students, faculty, and staff struggle to process what has happened over these last few weeks, they have taken the time to engage with our community, help our neighbors, and support one another. They've given rides, offered help with class assignments, and brought food. Across the university, we have leaned into our commitment to ensuring an environment that supports the safety and well-being of every member of our community. At our 5 campuses statewide, we are supporting ongoing efforts to provide food aid, emergency funding, transportation support, mental health resources to provide help to all the students who need it. We continue to offer access to our Twin Cities campus food pantry, Nutritious U, a resource that helps to address food insecurity on campus and provides fresh, free, and culturally connected food to everyone. No proof of need or student ID is required to order to receive food. Anyone can visit a food pantry once a week. To meet the needs of students who are unable to visit Nutritious U in person, we launched a short-term home delivery service. That service has provided large boxes of food donated by Second Harvest. Hundreds of those have been delivered. Boynton Health and the International Student and Scholar Services collaborated to offer no-cost prescription home delivery for international students as needed. Our transportation services team partnered with International Student Services and the University Retirees to welcome more than 50 of our new international students when they arrived back at the beginning of the semester and quickly and safely get them from the airport to their homes. Students were invited to attend many events focused on rights, resources, and resilience offered by the Office of Student Affairs, the Office of Equity and Diversity, and the International Student and Scholar Services Office. We've made a variety of mental health and well-being events and resources available across the 5 campuses at no cost, no appointment needed, with confidential conversations with a mental health counselor and telehealth options available. Now, my colleague, Greg Goldman, will share more about the university's approach to maintaining a safe campus environment. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Ritter. Mr. Goldman, welcome to the House Higher Education Committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to speak here today. For purposes of the record, my name is Greg Goldman, Executive Vice President for Finance and Operations at the University of Minnesota. The University of Minnesota Police Department remains focused on public safety, fostering trust, and maintaining strong relationships across the university community. Like other local police departments, UMPD does not enforce federal immigration laws, and our officers do not inquire about an individual's immigration status. We've taken concrete steps, guided by what our community needs, to strengthen both our security and our support systems. Due to this time, we've adjusted our security processes across the campus. These include tightening building access, increasing the presence of security personnel, and implementing new response protocols. Building access on the Twin Cities campus now requires U-Card access in most cases. Facilities management posted thousands of building access signs on nearly every building in the Twin Cities. We're committed to ensuring students, faculty, and staff are informed of how the university is responding to this situation. As a result, we've launched a comprehensive communication strategy to ensure the community gets timely and accurate information. The strategy includes weekly messages to students, providing updates on campus safety, and resources to address a variety of concerns, including academics, mental health and well-being, safety protocols, and building access. We've launched a new continually updated rapid response webpage that makes safety guidelines and resources easy to find. We've also developed coordinated leadership messages and weekly communication cascades to reach every corner of our university, including our students' families. We've also provided these messages to campus leaders at Crookston, Duluth, Morris, and Rochester campuses, enabling them to customize the cascade as needed. To ensure clarity, we've outlined the responsibilities and expectations of UMPD, shared what to do if students see or are approached by federal law enforcement, and confirm when safety alerts will be issued. I do want to take a moment to address rumors about federal immigration enforcement sightings on our campuses. While activity has taken place in some nearby neighborhoods, there have been no confirmed reports of federal immigration enforcement activity targeting any staff, faculty, or students on any of the University of Minnesota campuses since Operation Metro Surge began. We did have one staff member that was detained in another part of the city by agents participating in Operation Metro Surge, but that staff member has since been released. We continue to be transparent with students, faculty, and staff about federal immigration enforcement activity on campus throughout weekly communications and the Rapid Response webpage. In closing, I thank you for the opportunity to share the steps we've taken to ensure safety and well-being of our university community. As we move forward, our focus remains the same: keeping our campuses safe, supporting our students, faculty, and staff, and communicating clearly every step of the way. We'll continue to stand by our values, stay grounded in the facts, and make decisions that protect our community's well-being and ability to learn. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Goldman, Ms. Ritter, thank you both very much for your testimony. We ask that you please stick around to be available for questions at the conclusion of the presentations. Our final testifiers are representing Minnesota State System. I would like to welcome Scott Goings, Deidre Peasley, and Sharon Pierce to the testifier table. While they make their way to the table, members, I am pleased to report that we are running about 40 minutes ahead of schedule, so we will certainly have ample opportunity to answer all of your questions at the conclusion of the testimony. All right, Mr. Goings, welcome to the House Higher Education Committee. We ask you please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, for the record, my name is Scott Goings. I am general counsel for Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. As you know, Minnesota State is a large system of 33 colleges and universities at 54 locations throughout the state. We have over 270,000 students, over 14,000 employees. We have spent a substantial amount of time this last year preparing for the possibility of immigration enforcement on our campuses. Our goal has been, of course, to have a safe and welcoming campus environment where our students can flourish and achieve their educational goals, and where our campuses can prepare Minnesota's future workforce and serve the 54 locations that they exist in. Well, and we want to do that while complying with law, of course. So we have spent, the campuses have spent, with our support at the system office, a substantial amount of time reviewing their protocols for interaction with law enforcement, their communication protocols, and sharing that information with their campus communities. These things have included using existing campus protocols around emergency operations plans, communication systems with the campus community. Many of our campuses have done security reviews. Again, we are typically quite open, a lot of green space, welcome members of the public, and we've had campuses that have examined their profile around access to doors and requiring controlled access. Campuses have done tabletop exercises, which is a way of sort of practicing, giving a response based on various scenarios, again, to achieve a safe and welcoming environment but doing so in compliance with law. Campuses have examined their processes around access to student data, subpoena response, court order response, warrant response using our office. Looking through and examining their space to what is private, what is public, and so forth. Our focus has been on serving our students, and we're very appreciative of all the work that our faculty staff have done about accommodating and being flexible with students. With that as background, Mr. Chair, if I could, I would turn it over to my presidential colleagues to speak about impact on their campuses.
Thank you very much, Mr. Goings. Ms. Peasley, welcome to the Higher Education Committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. I am Deidre Peasley, president of St. Paul College. Chair Wolgamott and representatives, thank you so much for the opportunity to speak with you about the impact of Operation Metro Surge at St. Paul College. As a comprehensive community and technical college, we are proud of welcoming all types of students and creating an environment where each student knows they belong. Over the last couple of months, however, we have seen that many students do not know who they can trust, let alone feel like they belong, and the stakes are critical for them and their families. Our community college work is predicated on knowing when our students need support. Never have we envisioned a situation where our students have to go into hiding, limiting our ability to identify students needing help. For this semester, we adjusted our early term practices. Instead of waiting until after the 5-day add drop period to issue early alerts, we asked our faculty to report absences as soon as they noticed a pattern so advisors could reach out quickly and throughout the term. We reaffirmed faculty authority to define course parameters, things like attendance, word counts, assignment design, and encouraged flexibility wherever possible, including online options where faculty and program standards allowed. Despite calls to move quickly, we always need to assure changes do not harm students. And we have seen firsthand that legal status does not remove risk. Students who are lawfully present have been detained and transported to out-of-state facilities. The fear is broad and pervasive. Institutionally, this is what we're seeing. Decreasing enrollment and persistence. While spring enrollment remains higher than last year, the increase is a little over 3%, which was below the 7% growth that we were tracking before Operation Metro Surge. Drops for non-payment rose 10.6% from spring of 2025 to spring of 2026. Additionally, 61 refugee asylee students who were enrolled in fall of 2025 did not return this spring. We see changing safety and access patterns. More students are asking for evening classes because they feel safer moving after dark, or it is when a family member can drive them. Our students are reporting sudden changes to childcare, transportation, and household responsibilities tied to ICE activity, including students stepping in to care for siblings after parents have been deported. We have had numerous students impacted, but I will share just one student story that I think captures the stakes. One of our youngest students on a program internship for early childhood education had to keep many small children calm and safe while ICE attempted to enter the building. While we believe in providing experiential opportunities in the community, this is an intern experience no student should have to navigate. We have seen increased requests for basic needs and mental health assistance. In January of 2026, our food pantry provided 10,604 pounds of food across 616 visits. This is a 52% increase over January 2025. We're also seeing more proxy shoppers because students are afraid to leave home. We conducted 132 basic needs intake appointments in the first few weeks of the term, and this compares with 17 during the same period last year. This is what we are doing. We are communicating frequently with faculty and staff to ensure transparency and alignment in our responses. We are supporting faculty and offering flexible course options, including online participation where allowed by program, accreditation, and licensing requirements. We are expanding schedule options by adding more mid-semester starts for students who needed to withdraw early in the term. We are increasing academic grace by approving more drops without financial penalty. And we are conducting proactive outreach as advisors connect with students the moment faculty report patterns of absence or distress. And we are strengthening basic needs support through expanded food pantry capacity, increased intake appointments, and trauma-informed referrals. And throughout this, our employees have also been impacted personally with ICE activities near their homes or had family members detained. Plus, many employees report just high stress and the weight of not knowing how best to help in situations with students in these unprecedented times. Several employees have sought training in immigration law on their own so they can better support students and colleagues. They are showing up for students and for each other. Even if there is a drawdown, the trauma will not end when the headlines do and the agents leave. Operation Metro Surge has disrupted the educational experience of the various students our state most needs to thrive. Our students come to us sometimes doubting whether higher education is for them. They leave as childcare providers who make it possible for Minnesotans to go to work, as electricians who wire our homes, and as machinists who keep manufacturing moving. Minnesota's future depends on these learners. We cannot afford to lose them to fear. I'm grateful for the chance to share with you what we're seeing and doing at St. Paul College, and I'm happy to answer any of your questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Peasley. Ms. Pierce, welcome to the House Higher Education Committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm Sharon Pierce. I'm the president of Minneapolis College. Chair Wolgamott and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. When your name is Minneapolis College and national news and social media channels headline lives lost and violence in your city streets, you are impacted. Our college is part of Minneapolis, and when Minneapolis suffers, we suffer. Our campus reflects the rich diversity of the Twin Cities. Our students and employees live in the neighborhoods that have been most affected by the ICE surge. Many have seen their neighbors under siege and friends or family members being detained. Students have told us they fear that ICE will arrive on campus. They are scared and they are angry. This past month, we have seen an increase in the need for mental health counseling and other student supports. The increased demand is felt by our staff members who are stretched thin. The fear of traveling between campus and home has translated into requests to move classes online or to receive accommodations. While our faculty continue to work with students, many of our programs cannot be delivered online. These are hands-on programs tied directly to Minnesota's workforce needs that require in-person instruction. To meet the demand for information and reassurance, it has been necessary to implement a comprehensive multi-channel communication strategy. Our approach is measured. We focus on safety, calm, and clarity. In January alone, we issued 17 campus-wide communications. Our public safety team hosted 4 open sessions for students and employees. Community members ask difficult questions, expressing frustration and fear. We listened and responded as best we could. On January 24th, Alex Preddy, a Minneapolis College nursing graduate, was killed. On the 27th, we gathered as a campus community for an emotional in-person event and moment of silence. It was clear that his death had a significant impact on our community. The emotional toll of all of this is great, but the financial impact is just coming into focus. Before the surge, we experienced 3 years of positive enrollment growth. But as spring semester began in mid-January, we were down in new enrollments by 16%. We believe that decline was due to the ICE surge. With fewer students on campus, facilities-related revenue, including parking, college store sales, and other on-site services declined. This trend reflects the fear and disruption experienced by our students. Minneapolis College was founded to expand access to education for those who need it most. But access is not just about tuition or financial aid. It is about whether students feel safe enough to come to campus, and whether their basic needs are secure enough for them to stay. While the financial ramifications of the ICE surge have placed significant strain on our college, our responsibility does not change. We remain steady and we remain focused on supporting faculty, students, and staff. Thank you for your time and for your continued support of higher education in Minnesota.
Thank you, Ms. Pierce. And we ask that you, as well as Ms. Peasley and Mr. Goings, please stick around in case there are any other any questions from members. Are there, before we proceed to member questions, I just want to provide the opportunity, if there are any other members of the public who are here today wishing to provide testimony on the impact of Operation Metro Surge on Minnesota's colleges and universities. Okay. Welcome to the House Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee. We ask, just for the sake of time for everyone, that you please confine your testimony to 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Tan. Thank you, Chair Wolgamont. Thank you, everyone else that's here on the committee. I was one of the stories that were told here today. And I just want to further what was said. I personally, I want to share how difficult it has been for my family. For me, it's been over a month since my stepdad had been taken. And between that, he was a main source of income for us. He has made a lot of financial decisions with us. And not only that, my mom is Vietnamese speaking primarily. So he had been like the language broker for us, being able to tell us what to do, inform us of how to do things. And he'd been taken away. And now it's been hard to take on school, my job, caring for my family. My heat broke down the other day. I had to figure out how to take care of that. Cars broke down recently. I have had to figure out just how to take care of my family and manage everything that I'm doing. And I barely can get any sleep just thinking about what is happening in the facility that he's been taken in. He has been moved multiple times. We don't know where he is. We don't know where, we do know now, but it's, the system is also difficult to even support him, to get him what he wants and what he needs for us to even communicate with him. And I have a twin brother also, but he also is having to struggle everything with me and my family. And I have taken on a role of becoming the leader of the house to just take on expenses, even though it's just not something I've done before. And it's been really difficult. And I don't know if he's ever gonna get out or if he's gonna get deported, but even that doesn't matter. It matters, but I just want him to be safe no matter where he is. And it just hurts to know that he isn't, and it hurts to just try to keep up with everything. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for sharing your testimony and your story. We ask you please stick around in case members have any questions for you. Thank you so much. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify on the impact of Operation Metro Surge on Minnesota's colleges and universities? Welcome to the House Higher Education Committee. We ask for the sake of time that you confine your testimony to 2 minutes. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair. Hi, my name is Fatima Duba. I'm from St. Paul College. I am a student there, and I also serve as a housing resource navigator. So I am part of the basic needs team, and a lot of the times that means when emergency situations come up, our office is the first to hear about it. I'm speaking today because clearly everyone in this room has a commitment to higher education. And when we think of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, education is definitely a privilege. It is secondary when survival is threatened, and it's secondary when your day-to-day is interrupted by things that are outside of your control. Our community has been shaken by this, and my personal experience as both a student and as someone who serves the community there is disruption and chaos. I have been raised in Minnesota almost my entire life, and this is home, and it's really an othering experience for someone to look at you and perceive something that is completely, whether my legal status, where I came from, whether I speak the language, to be othered and to be looked at as less than and treated as less than is not an experience that just I have, but also my fellow students, students that I work with and students that I'm friends with have chosen not to come back this semester. Because when it comes to the privilege of being able to learn versus the safety of their family and friends, safety comes first. So I hope that as you guys brainstorm paths forward, that you keep in mind that everyone in this room is enormously privileged, thankfully, to have the space and opportunity to be here. And there are many others that don't have that opportunity and I wanted to speak on today. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for sharing your story and your testimony. We ask that you please stick around in case members have any questions. Okay, last chance. Are there any other members of the public who wish to provide testimony on the impact of Operation Metro Surge on Minnesota's colleges and universities? Okay, seeing none, we will now proceed to member questions. Members, if you could please, before asking your question, if you could please identify the testifier whom you would like to ask a question of, we can have them come to the table and then you can proceed with your questions. The first member on our list is Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is going to be for President Pribnow.
And I should have said this earlier. Unfortunately, President Pribnow had to leave at 2 o'clock, but we will make sure that you can give us your questions and we will coordinate with President Pribnow to give response to your question. Representative Novotny, is there anyone else you would like to ask a question of?
Could you come back to me later then?
Absolutely. Okay, the next member on our list is Vice Chair Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to begin just by acknowledging and thanking everybody who spoke here today. And I am likewise disappointed that President Pribnow had to leave because I wanted to, in particular, thank him. As a lifelong ELCA Lutheran, I know the special place that Augsburg holds within the broader Minnesota Lutheran community and what that school means to so many of us in my particular faith. You can probably hear that I'm struggling a little bit. Some of you know that my mom was a community college instructor for 39 years, and so I'm just feeling some feelings right now, to be honest. I should be clear, I don't have any questions, but I do think, I want to just encourage all of my colleagues on this committee to hear and acknowledge and to the best that we can speak to the very real fear that exists among students and staff and faculty and administrators at our colleges and universities. A fear that I think was reinforced again as has been mentioned just today when we know that ICE agents apprehended someone in a campus owned residence hall at Columbia University in New York. And that fear exists with a great deal of uncertainty We simply cannot predict what's going to happen, how this administration will, what this administration will or will not do, and what any federal immigration agents will or will not do. And so I think we just need to acknowledge that. There is one quote from one of our testifiers, I think it was Mr. Fitzgerald, that just keeps running through my head. He said, he said, people were running from building to building. And what that called to my mind, the image that called to my mind was reports you hear from school shootings and other school violence that we've seen. And I think this moment calls for us as leaders, as policymakers, to do what we can. And I don't think anybody here would say that we can anticipate every circumstance. I don't think anybody would say that we can completely eliminate the fear, the uncertainty. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't try. We, as leaders, as members of the higher education community, we have a moral, a social, and I would argue a financial responsibility to protect and support the learning that happens on our college and university campuses and the potential that every single student brings to their education, and to support and protect the staff and faculty and administrators who support them in that learning. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Vice Chair Coulter. Next up on our list is Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair. My question is actually for Sudi Adao, the president of LEAD MN. Is that, would you mind?
President Adao, please proceed to the testifier table. Representative Hicks, you have the floor.
Thank you so much, Chair. And I want to first thank you, everyone, all of the students who came and testified today. But I want to thank you for coming from Rochester. As I listened to folks talk today, I think Metro Surge somehow implies that it's in the 7-county metro. And we know in Rochester that that's not true. It's in Greater Minnesota, too. It's in Rochester, and it's in St. Cloud, and it's in Duluth, and it's in Lewiston and Fairmont, it's everywhere. Metro Surge, the title we keep referencing, implies that it's not happening across Minnesota, and it is. And so I wanted to say thank you for coming and bringing that voice of students in Greater Minnesota to the committee. I did want to ask you a specific question, though, and this actually comes from a student at RCTC that I spoke to. Can you share a little bit with me how our students are feeling, particularly those in the healthcare space, when they have to go from campus to Mayo or OMC or to other places for their internships? What kinds of things are you hearing from your classmates, if anything?
Ms. Adao.
What I'm hearing from my classmates is fear. I'm hearing them come up with strategic ways to try and carpool and see how they can get to and from places when they should just be focusing on getting there. But instead, they're focusing on how they can avoid coming in contact with one of these ICE agents. And I've heard from students who take extra time to look at license plates and to look in the car, and if somebody is looking a little too hard at them, that maybe something might happen. So the general consensus of those that have talked to me is that they're just afraid. Yeah.
Thank you. Representative Hicks.
I want to thank you for bringing those stories. That's also very similar to what I'm hearing from students in the healthcare field. I've talked to folks who have told me that they don't know what to do because they have to go to their clinicals, and they're terrified of getting to their clinicals. They're afraid that something could happen while they were at their clinicals. It's been a very emotional conversation when I've spoken to students, and I've only spoken to a couple, but I had a feeling it was a theme, and they were the majority, not the minority, kind of feeling that way. So I thank you for bringing that forward. And I just challenge this committee, the fastest growing economic field in the state of Minnesota is healthcare. The biggest place where we are lacking educated workforce is in healthcare. And statistically, many of our students going into healthcare are from immigrant families. If they cannot get the training that they need to be the nurses and the radio techs and the paramedics and the EMTs, we do not have a healthcare system that will sustain. And so what's happening and the fear that they're feeling is now and very present. But the consequences for that is they don't go to their clinicals. The consequences for that is they end their program. And I am very concerned about the long-term consequences of our students in healthcare fields that are no longer in healthcare fields. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you. If you could please stay, I just would like to do a follow-up. So following the events of our dear beloved Speaker Emerita Hortman's death, many of us in the room experienced this feeling of hypervigilance, right? I still jump when I hear a loud noise around my house and or see something on my street that I'm not accustomed to. I think it's a feeling that most of us can deal with. I heard you describing that same type of hypervigilance, the constant looking over the shoulder, the constant fear. I think when we use the word fear, just, you know, it's like, okay, I'm afraid of a spider, or, you know, I'm afraid that donut is going to do bad things to me, right? But this trauma of hypervigilance, right? I just want you to know that I heard it, and that I'm acknowledging it as real and valid and important that you shared your story, and the other man shared his story as well. Because if we don't hear these stories, we don't understand the impact. I'm sure there's loss of sleep, loss of appetite, all of the things that make us nervous that we're not even talking about in the room. And it is real trauma. And I just want to acknowledge that. So thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Cleavorn. Now we'll bring it back to Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for coming back. So, and this is, you can see it down. Thank you. My question would have been for Mr. Pribnow, or President Pribnow. There's many questions and branches that it would have been, so it's really hard for me to even know what his testimony would have been. I would have liked to know if he was actually on scene. I would have actually liked to know if he's ever been on scene or had a similar reaction for other arrests or incidents involving any law enforcement on campus. Given the location of Augsburg and my familiarity with being down here and the neighborhood that it's in and knowing students that have gone to Augsburg, I would suggest that there's been many serious incidents and arrests in or near Augsburg. I'd like to point out that the incident that he described as documented in an NPR article, so I would assume that he would agree that it's pretty favorable testimony from his, you know, standpoint and statements that he made at the time. He eventually, in his articles, goes on to say that eventually 10 to 12 people showed up as they were trying to block the arrest. So I'm really wondering if and he has a quote that he was proud of what they did and that this all worked out. And even the article indicates that there were security guards that were involved. And this wasn't a jump out. It sounds like it was had to be a drawn out event for all the people to get there. But we can't get those facts out of Mr. Pribnow because he left. when you asked him not to, and when you knew that we would have questions for that. I wonder, and I also would have asked Mr. Pribnow, what they did after the October 8th incidents in Israel, and when the Jewish students were being attacked. And we've got University of Minnesota people here. Mr. Goldman, could you come up?
Thank you, Mr. Goldman. Representative Novotny.
Executive Vice President Goldman, what plans, you talked about the tabletop issues that were put into place. What kind of things were done after the October 7th Israel incidences? Did you plan for that? Did you have plans for how to resist people that were protesting and trying to add? I take it back. They actually did break into campus buildings.
Mr. Goldman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I don't believe my testimony was the one that talked about tabletops, and it's hard for me to state because exactly. I started at the university November 14th of 2024. So unfortunately, I was not on campus or in my role at the time of those incidents.
Would have been
Representative Novotny.
Thank you. Then I'll just make a statement, Mr. Chair, and I'll be done here. I was first elected to the legislature in 2020. And if you recall, we went through quite a crime spree around the University of Minnesota campus in the post-COVID era. And multiple students were shot on the streets of Dinkytown. Whether it was on the street or a crack in the sidewalk, that would make it a University of Minnesota property. I would have really liked to have known what tabletop exercises we did then. And at any point, did somebody from the University of Minnesota, you're there now, Mr. Goldman, are you instructing your students how to comply with federal law? And are you explaining to them that not every person in an unmarked SUV is an ICE agent? Maybe they're actually doing legitimate local law enforcement.
Mr. Goldman.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Member. So as I said during my testimony, we do have numerous opportunities, websites, communications to campus, talking about what students should and should not do, what we as a community would and would not do. So certainly, we, as I've said, we do not support, nor do we ask for the documentation of anybody we stop. Certainly, being a public university, we support all law enforcement activities that are legal and lawful, be it on campus, be it in Dinkytown, or all of the city. As you may know, we actually quite often participate in mutual aid to support the rest of the community during the surge as Minneapolis police had to do other things. So certainly our students, by way of websites, communications, are well-versed, and if they choose to have accurate and timely information as to what they should or should not do, should they be approached or confronted or detained, and students can choose to read and digest that information or not, as they choose to.
Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. So, and you're just going to be a proxy that, thank you for answering that. I am aware, I do get the emails. So it's it was a setup question for you. I would have loved to have that question to Mr. Pribnow. I would have loved to ask Mr. Pribnow if he was instructing his students. And from the article that I read on NPR, it sounds like he's instructing his students to obstruct. And I hope that's not true. Because although they might be whipped up into a fury about ICE, they probably might not know exactly who they're dealing with. And they might find themselves in an arrest of someone that's very dangerous. We just saw the incident last week where the person was released from Hennepin County and then within 3 hours went and shot his family up, and short time later was involved in a shooting where he was ultimately killed after he exchanged fire with law enforcement. I would hope you would encourage your students not to be involved in something like that, because it could be very serious and they don't know. And with that, I'll be done. I just wish Mr. Pribnow would have stayed, and I wish he'd come back to committee at some point. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for that, Representative Novotny. You have my commitment as chair that we will do whatever coordinating we have to do to get your questions answered. Next up for member discussion is Representative Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I just wanted to say thank you to all who came and testified. Our state was under invasion, just to let you know. My own district that we're hearing right now, where Augsburg University is, the University of Minnesota, what we have seen and witnessed personally, even including the incident that began at Augsburg University, simply they were demanding to see a judicial warrant.
Right.
When they were pushed back by federal agents, when they snatched the student and made accusations that are non-existent about that student, this was not a normal process. I wish you will have seen what was happening in my neighborhoods. To the extent that people are fearful of law enforcement from the federal government while they have done nothing wrong. Individuals who are U.S. citizens, their civil rights have been abused. To the extent that folks are now questioning themselves if they belong. This is not who we are. And I want to tell the students, we see you, we hear you, and we are with you, making sure that you've got a safe space to learn, making sure that the student who was grabbed from St. Cloud, kept in a hotel room with agents, a minor student, because she was here legally. Nothing wrongdoing was done. But a student to be kidnapped from St. Cloud to be brought to the Twin Cities to stay in a hotel room, a 17-year-old, I don't know what we're doing. We should be questioning when our own law enforcement is doing such things, let alone the killing of 2 U.S. citizens and the shooting in North Minneapolis. That the information that we're being fed, what we're being told not to believe, what we have seen with our own eyes, what we have witnessed, is absolutely unacceptable. And we need to do better. As state legislators, we need to protect our residents against the atrocities that are being committed right here in our own state. I know we don't have much time. Mr. Chair, thank you so much for bringing this discussion so that the students can have their voices.
Thank you, Representative Noor. Next up for member discussion is Representative Duran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Rep. Noor, for that, because I'm actually going to hit kind of on the same thing, is making sure that everybody is safe. Every single person that goes to our schools, every single person that lives in the state of Minnesota, we should all feel safe. That comes with cooperation. That comes with talking. That comes with working together. Not by fighting. Not by telling people that we're going against Gestapos. We as legislators and we as presidents and everybody inside here have an obligation to protect every single person in this state and who is under our care. But we refused at a point in time. We decided to go political. We decided to go the left and the rights, and we all just wanted to fight and not talk, not work together, not bring down the rhetoric, not help out our community, not understand that a little bit of cooperation and understanding of what's going to happen could have easily lowered the rhetoric to not put people in situations that they were in. We, as legislators, took it to the next level when we started attacking cops and started attacking federal agents. So when we have it right away that automatically that we need to do something now, we should have did something before it got to that point. We shouldn't even be having this conversation. I mean, the University of Minnesota has professors telling people how to pretty much jump in and violate federal law. Cover students up. Put your bodies on the line. How many times have we heard that? You're impeding a federal investigation. Whether you like it or not, they have a job to do. I would have asked to lower the rhetoric a long time ago. Everybody come together. Let's talk about things. Let's lower the rhetoric. Let's actually do something good for the state of Minnesota instead of keep fighting over things. When we fight over ICE, we put our local law enforcement in jeopardy. We put our students and everybody else in jeopardy. We can continue it on this road, but it's only going to hurt the ones who we in this room are saying we care about. So I would recommend that we, as legislators and presidents, learn to work together instead of fighting each other.
Before I proceed to down the list of member discussion, I just wanted to share for everyone, Representative Otney and anyone else who's hoping to question, President Priveno actually did beforehand let us know that he would need to leave early on, but we're still grateful to have him and get his testimony. And again, Representative Novotny, and to any of the other members, we'll make sure that you get your questions answered. Next up on our list of member discussion is Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wondered if I could have representatives from the University of Minnesota and Minnesota State, and then if there's somebody still here from the private colleges that could come to the table, maybe Gretchen Ritter, Executive Vice President and Provost at the U. I'm not sure of those Minnesota State folks who might want to come to the table. I just had some questions about on campus kind of policy sort of questions.
All right. Ms. Ritter and Mr. Goings, thank you for making your way to the testifier table, as well as Mr. Goldman. Representative Scott, please proceed with your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for coming back to the table. Student groups have requested no voluntary cooperation with ICE and clear restrictions on campus access. Have institutions such as yours implemented any such directives, and do those policies go beyond what federal law requires?
Ms. Ritter.
Thank you for the question. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, committee members. As we have said, we have instructed everyone to obey the law. We repeat that often. It is, of course, within a student or a staff member's rights to, in appropriate circumstances, ask to see identification or ask to see a warrant if someone is seeking access to a space. If there are any difficulties in those circumstances, we tell them, please just back away and make sure that you contact someone else higher up in the staff or our university police.
All right, Mr. Goings.
Thank you. Really the same at Minnesota State. We have to follow the law. For example, student and employee data is generally private under the Family Education Rights and Privacy Act and the Data Practices Act, but it's subject to, of course, a lawful subpoena, a lawful court order, a lawful warrant, and we will have to comply with that, and we do, and that's been the case for years, and it continues to be the case.
Representative Scott.
Thank you for those answers. I'm just wondering if there was any communication sent out to your students during the past month or so here regarding how they should, was it like, I know there are apps and everything now that you can send mass communication to all the students. So this is what they were advised, is just to comply. Is that what I'm
hearing? Ms. Ritter.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. Yes, always. We also remind students who want to exercise freedom of respect of expression that they do so within lawful norms, and we have campus rules around that as well.
Representative Scott.
I was just going to listen for the other test.
Mr. Goings.
Thank you. Yes, we've communicated to our campuses suggested protocols, and that typically involves not having every employee, every community member having to figure out what to do, but if there is an interaction with law enforcement, including ICE, refer them to campus security. We don't have licensed law enforcement, we have campus security, and so they can they know what to do at that point. I will say that we specifically in our protocol have communicated to all our community members that they should not physically interfere with law enforcement activity.
Members, before I give the floor back to Representative Scott, I would like to announce that although there are 5 minutes left of our regularly scheduled committee time, I would like to make sure that all of our members of this committee have the opportunity to ask whatever questions they may like to ask. So we'll be extending this committee time by an additional 5 minutes. If you need to leave at the regularly designated 2:45 time, we completely understand. However, we will be extending this committee by 5 minutes to make sure that members have the opportunity for their questions to be answered. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, next up on our list for member discussion is Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate it. I dropped my pen, hold on. I don't know where it went. Oh, there it is. I wasn't going to speak up today, but my friend Representative Duran just had to kind of poke something, ask some questions. I'm happy to answer them for you. So I want to talk about how it started in my community, a suburb, not the cities. We are not Minneapolis, though a lot of people from Minneapolis moved to my community. My backyard overlooks the Minneapolis River skyline. It's beautiful. And all of a sudden, one day, on a fairly busy road, main road in our community, men in masks and what looked to get to me as a family of military, like men who had put together costumes that were cobbled together off the clearance rack at the PX, and like they had like put their costume together on Call of Duty and then brought it into the real world. It was not professional. It was an embarrassment to law enforcement everywhere, including my own in my city, who is upstanding and who has gone through a lot. It wasn't, they didn't have clear markings, they didn't have clear indicators, they didn't have badges visible, they didn't have any of that. And there were two people walking home from the grocery store, and they chased them in the middle of the day, broad daylight, and they didn't know who was chasing them. It looked to them like it was just masked weirdos chasing them, frankly, with guns. They didn't announce themselves, they had no idea who these men were. They ran into their home, and their door was quickly broken into. There was no knocking, there was no warrant shown, there was no nothing. And neighbors, it was in a small cul-de-sac right off of a main road, and so people were concerned when they saw this activity, because eventually a lot of cars showed up in a place where there weren't a lot. This hit the news, you can all see what happened from there. But after that, I pulled into one of my neighborhood parks with my dog in the back seat. I have a new puppy, for anyone who didn't know. He likes to walk. We walk 5 to 10 miles a day. So it was very important for me to get my dog out for a walk that day. I pulled into a park that's not even 2 miles from my house. And as I pulled into what is normally a very empty parking lot, I was met with over 50 agents who did have clear markings on their uniforms, with my dog in the back seat. And as I pulled in, there was Bearcats, probably 40 or 50 different vehicles parked around this lot. none of which like had Minnesota plates on them, which was very strange to me. And I was very confused. So I pulled in and I tried to go find the one spot away from them that I could park in to go walk my dog, thinking it was maybe just an event I didn't know about or there was a legitimate law enforcement activity happening, right? Like I did not want to be in the middle of it. As I pulled in to pull around, people walked in front of my car and pulled guns on me. And I was, at this time, they did not know I was a representative. They did not know who I was, nothing. And asked me what I was doing there at a public park less than 2 miles from my house where I always walk my dog. So that wasn't scary enough. I turned around and left because I was afraid, frankly, as a woman alone in that situation. And I was going back to my house. They followed me. I thought, well, that's strange. There's a lot of cars that follow me, a bear cat and all. Well, they weren't following me. They were just going to a house in my neighborhood. And over 50 agents, 50 cars and agents got out of their vehicles and surrounded a block in my very secluded neighborhood right before the school bus was dropping kids off. And they had guns drawn on all sides of the house. Again, some had some uniforms on, some just had like t-shirts with jeans. It was clearly not Burnsville PD. And I watched and observed from a distance, did not get involved. I'm terrified. I did not want anything to do with it. But over the course of the next 3 hours, the students who were coming home on the bus couldn't get to their houses because they had blocked all the roads off. As I did try to talk and said, I'm the representative for this area. I live down the street. This is my community. These kids are trying to get home. They refused to move their cars. They called me things like cunt, bitch, slut, after recognizing who I was. Again, an embarrassment to law enforcement. So that went on for, like I said, about 3 hours. Eventually, I was able to talk to the family who was there. They had pulled a bear cat into their front yard, broken their door too. And as they were walking away with a man, that they walked right by my car, because I stayed in my car the whole time, I heard them say, well, we couldn't find the guy we were looking for, but this one will do. His name's Jose. He's been in custody since December 9th. He was transferred, I found later, to El Paso, where he ate every 3 days he was fed. He he had to shower every 4 or 5 days, once a week is what he called it. What's ironic is his wife was trying to hand the agents his passport as he was leaving. They refused to take it because they had shown up with quite literally a camera crew. They had lighting people and everything, drones above, and guys with cameras, like the shake-proof whatever setups, following them around as they, like, my brothers play Call of Duty, my son plays Call of Duty. I can't tell you how much it reminded me of that situation in my own quiet neighborhood. And I don't know how many times do you try to talk to people who speak to you that way once you've told them who you are as, you know, someone trying to get answers for your community? How many times do you just try to talk to them and do nothing more as you watch the Constitution be violated right before your eyes? I watched them smash in the windows of a car. I was getting coffee at Caribou, and all of a sudden I heard this smash. They had smashed in the window of a man's car. And I went over to ask, near my district, asked him what happened. And they told me about who this man was because he was taken away so quickly by plainclothes officers. I didn't know what had happened, if it was ICE or not. And they told me he was a widow. His wife had just died of cancer a few months ago after giving birth to their child. So he was now a widow with two young babies to look after. He was here legally. He'd done nothing wrong. The children had to go into the custody of child protection that afternoon. I watched ICE follow a woman through my community. She called me because she was alone and she was scared, and she had my phone number from a long, long time ago, and she didn't know who was following her. I met her at a local restaurant, and they circled the block over and over. She's not an immigrant. She's not an observer. She had done nothing else, but they had catcalled her a bunch of times.
Representative Hansen,
okay, I'll wrap it up.
I so appreciate what you're sharing. I want to make sure we get all members to have the chance to speak.
I understand that. And I just want to say, like, there's no talking to men like that. So when we can talk, when we can tackle the way that the men like that will interact with us, right, how am I to professionally interact with somebody who calls me a slut after I identify myself as a representative, right? How do I represent myself that way? It's a challenge. And I would say that we need to see more professionalism from them if they want to work together. But this was not a matter of not working together. Violations of the 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, and 14th Amendment were not a matter of working together. So I'll wrap it up there, Chair, but I'm happy to talk about the stories in my community. I could go on for days. I saw hundreds of incidents that violated our Constitution. And as somebody sitting among people who swore an oath to the Constitution, I think we should be really concerned about that. It's not partisan. It's nothing. It is a matter of humanity. And as a woman of faith, I just think it is important that we do not backslide into a world where it's easier to judge, deflect, and be cold and detached from what people are going through. So.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Representative Liebling.
Well, Mr. Chair, it's hard to even speak after listening to that, honestly. And I see Representative Duran over there kind of laughing and giggling, smiling. I'm just stunned by what I just heard, and I'm really stunned and really emotional, I have to tell you, by the stories that I heard here from everyone who testified. Thank you all to those of you. I mean, it is just, you know, this isn't law enforcement. If they are here to do a job, they are not doing that job. They are doing all this other thing. They are committing crimes. And a lot of the time, people have only their word that, and they don't even say anything. They don't even say they're law enforcement. You just heard it from Representative Hansen. It is not a joke, Representative Duran. It is not a joke. These people are not trained the way you were trained as a police officer. They are not doing what our local police officers do. So, yeah, you were asking these folks, you know, were other kind of about, aren't there other things that make people fearful and stuff? Well, sure. But we have a system. We have local police officers who, generally speaking, are trusted, and people think there's a remedy, and if people commit crimes, they can be held accountable. And these people come into our communities, and they commit crimes, and there is no accountability. There is none. By and large, the communities have responded peacefully. It has been astounding how peaceful they have been in the face of these kind of attacks. It is just absolutely astounding that you would talk about cooperating with them, cooperating. I know Republicans like to say, oh, maybe walls should have been more cooperative. Listen, Trump stated from the beginning this was about retribution, and it clearly is. These people come into our communities. They don't talk to our local law enforcement. They don't coordinate with our local sheriffs. They don't tell anybody where they're going or what they're going to be doing. Some of the time, you don't even know who they are. They're covering their faces. So if they don't want to be called Gestapo and things like that, they shouldn't act like that. But that is what they are acting like. And not only that, but when they kill somebody, they don't even cooperate with the BCA. And they have said that Trump's Department of Justice, we need a different name because it is not a Department of Justice. They do not even cooperate when somebody is killed. They don't cooperate with our state law enforcement agencies. They have said it very clearly. So I don't know what this cooperate and this wouldn't happen thing is. If we had remedies for this, maybe they would think twice before they do it. And the problem is right now, there isn't any. And there is no way for communities to, there's nothing for us to do. There's no way where for anyone to go. And honestly, it's the Republicans here who have the power to do something more than the Democrats do, and I put it on you. Unless we're all lying, unless the videos are all lying, something is happening here in our state and in our country that is well beyond partisanship. We all have to get together and recognize the seriousness of this. And I'm just not understanding why the Republican members do not seem to understand. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Members, that's all the time that we have for today. I'd like to thank you for participating in today's hearing. There being no further business before the committee, we are adjourned.